Okay, welcome back to the Peter Mac Show as we begin the second hour here. Sorry to cut you off there, John, at the break. So I was just pointing out, you know, that I think Supreme Court justices, I mean, I think I would have assumed prior to asking this question that these people would be experts on the Constitution.
They're not.
They're not.
Not from my point, they're not.
Right. Well, if they don't even understand how to do research or not willing to do research on what is implied by the Ninth Amendment, which you say is relatively readily available.
Yeah,
right?
Well, that's because in the case of Scalia, I think he's concerned that if he opens that box, yeah, a lot of things are going to fly out that he doesn't want to have flying around. He's concerned that people are going to find rights that he doesn't want them to have.
Well, that's pretty scary. It makes me think of the metaphor that Randy Barnett used on my show some 3 years ago, and that's it, that what was founded in this country is a situation where we have a sea of liberty and then islands of government power. But as the government sees it, that whole relationship has been inverted to where there are islands of liberty in a sea of government power. And it sounds like what you're saying is Scalia believes in this sea of governmental power, and he doesn't want more of these little islands of rights popping up.
That's about the way I would summarize it, yeah.
That's pretty scary.
He would have to speak for himself. We'll have to get him on the show sometime.
Oh, well, yeah. If you can help me get him on the show, that would be great.
I think we might have better luck getting Clarence Thomas on. Right,
yeah.
Right now, he's tooling around the country in a big motorhome, million dollar motorhome. I don't know how he was able to afford that, but anyway, that's what he likes to do during the summer.
Huh. Wow. Well, let's take another caller. We have Bob from Texas on the line. Go ahead, Bob. Okay, I guess we lost Bob from Texas. So, well, gosh, John, I mean, I don't know. I'm just exasperated with this situation of trying to get people that you would assume are fair-minded and, you know, astute legal scholars, like you assume that people on the Supreme Court would be, and it just astounds me, not completely, I guess, but because I've seen one example of that, where these judges are not they're not inclined to learn about the limitations of government power, then, if I'm summarizing you correctly.
Yeah, well, there's even a problem in the academic community. I'm on one of these email listservs of constitutional law professors, and they get really bothered if you venture into, you know, these areas. They'll dance around with minor points of, you know, interpretation or, you know, scholarship, but they don't want to address the deeper issues. And, of course, they're concerned that it might disturb their ability to get appointed to a judgeship someday. But
aha, yeah. If they don't side with the, getting back to Randy Barnett's metaphor, if they don't side with the view that what we have is a sea of governmental power with little islands of government liberty, then they might not get a justice position.
Well, I don't think
right?
They think of it in quite those terms. They just want to avoid controversy. And my positions on constitutional issues tend to be controversial.
Well, and an academic is supposed to be one who embraces controversy. I mean, isn't that part of the learning process?
You would think so, but you try to introduce some of my positions into their discussions, and they just, you know, go silent.
Wow, that's really sad. Wow, the problem is so deep then that people do not want to address these issues, isn't it?
Yeah, especially if you try to bring up something like the Federal Reserve or the income tax.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they are really scared of that.
Right. Well, let's talk about that when we get back. Hang with us, folks. We are due for another break right now. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 800-313-9443.
In Matthew 24, the disciples asked Jesus, "What shall be the signs of thy coming and the end of the world?" Jesus answered them, "You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines, diseases, earthquakes in many places. Fellow Americans, we are living in this time of Earth's history. People everywhere are trying to understand these climatic world events in light of human wisdom, but without the wisdom of God, this is impossible. Our ministry would like to offer information on the Mark of the Beast and the Unholy Alliance. It includes four books and several DVDs for your information. It discusses America in prophecy, the Antichrist, tyrants and wars, secret societies, the New World Order, and much more. So to be prepared for what is coming on the world as an overwhelming surprise, call for your free materials, Packet F. 888-211-1715. Again, 888-211-1715.
The ideology powering the Democrats and Republicans is not liberalism or conservatism, but globalism. Globalists are concerned with what's good for big business and the American empire instead of what's fair for the American people. The only antidote to the poison of globalism is nationalism. Start reading the Nationalist Times each month. The Nationalist Times promotes a common sense, intelligent, and passionate alternative to the reigning party line. Published monthly since 1985, the Nationalist Times is a 20-page newspaper featuring outstanding writers and columnists who don't believe in taboos or sacred cows. Be one of the many thousands of loyal readers of the Nationalist Times. Subscribe now to the Nationalist Times. Just $19 for 1 year. That's 50% off the regular price. Send your $19 subscription to the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. That's the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. Or subscribe online at our website, www.anu.org.
Hi, this is Brother Michael Diamond from Most Holy Family Monastery. We are now offering a critically important $10 package. The package contains three DVDs with 10 different programs, our new 658-page book called The Truth About What Really Happened to the Catholic Church After Vatican II, which is the most comprehensive book ever produced on what has happened to the Catholic Church in the last 50 years. You also get another 335-page book and other material. Order now at our website, mostholyfamilymonastery.com. The last word monastery is spelled M-O-N-A-S-T-E-R-Y. At the website, you can watch all of our videos for free, read sample chapters of the new book and other articles, or call us 24 hours a day at 1-800-275-1126. That's 1-800-275-1126. Or you can mail in your order to us at Most Holy Family Monastery, 4425 Schneider Road, Fillmore, New York, 14735. The price of the whole package is $10, which includes media mail shipping, $15 for UPS ground, or $30 outside the U.S. MostHolyFamilyMonastery.com.
Okay, welcome back to the Peter Mac Show. We're beginning our second hour. We're just a bit into it now with my special guest, John Roland, who is the president and founder of the Constitution Society, and he maintains a website, constitution.org, which just has a wealth of information on there about studying the Constitution, and as he says in the beginning there, about answering questions about what is constitutional and what is not. John, when you said that these judges don't know the law sometimes, it did remind me of my experience in the courtroom where Larkin Rose was tried 2 years ago in Philadelphia, and the presiding judge was Michael Bailson. And at one point he said, well, there was an amendment to the Constitution that created the income tax, but he couldn't recall what it was. I thought that was rather interesting right there, that here a man is presiding over a federal trial concerning what the income tax actually requires and whether a person on trial there, the defendant, of course, was Larkin Rose, was guilty of willful failure to file, and he couldn't recall the name of the amendment that the IRS at least hangs its hat on. Plus, he just got it factually wrong. I mean, Lincoln instituted an income tax back in, I think it was 1862. And so, I mean, it was just amazing to me that here is a federal judge who is just this ignorant of federal law and Supreme Court decisions.
Well, not only that, but the odds are that somebody quoted the income tax amendment in their pleadings, so it sounds like the judge didn't read the pleadings.
Right.
Which, of course, which is very common. A lot of these judges don't bother to read all the pleadings. They just, you know, look to see who the lawyers are and say, okay, I'll go with this guy.
Right.
Now, another
boy,
thing they like to do is to lie to the jury.
I'm sorry? Say that again?
Judges like to lie to juries.
In what way?
Well, in telling them what the law is, that the law is something that it's not. I saw that happen in the Tom Clayton trial here in Austin. I mean, you know, the judge, Sam Sparks, just flat out lied to the jury about what the law is.
What did he say specifically?
Well, he said that the income is this and the taxpayer is that and this is all in the such and such a law. And no, it's not.
Right.
You know, he just made it up.
Right. Yeah, and Tom Clayton is serving some 4 years in prison after that event, yep. Isn't he?
That's, well, I think last I heard it was on appeal. I don't know if
it's... Well, it's on appeal, but he's still in prison.
I thought he was out while he appealed.
No, he's in prison. I just wrote to him the other day, and he wrote me back from prison. So
okay,
he's very hopeful on his appeal, as we all are, of course.
Yep.
But, we just have to wake up Americans to what's going on and how corrupt the judiciary is, at virtually every level, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the trouble is the American people have forgotten that the reason why we have a jury system is because judges and lawyers can't be trusted.
Right.
And I keep telling people, if you're ever on a jury and the law is not argued in your presence, acquit.
Right.
Because right off the bat, that's a violation of his right to a jury trial.
Exactly.
If the law is not argued in the presence of the jury, it's not a jury trial.
Right.
Might have the
that would render most trials not jury trials then, because judges say they won't allow either side to discuss the law. Judges say, I will tell you what the law is, just as you said the judge in Tom Clayton's trial did.
Right.
And they'll get it wrong.
Yep. So that means that people have to go into the jury already knowing the law, which is, of course, a kind of a tall order. Either that or they're going to have to look it up when they get home, which they're instructed not to do.
Well, but they also have the right to rule not just on the facts, but the law itself. And judges routinely tell juries that they must restrict their decision-making deliberations to the facts and not the law. But in fact, it goes back to what the first Chief Justice of the United States, that juries have the right to judge both the law and the facts.
Yeah, well, what they try to gloss over is the fact that in our constitutional system of government, all law is a matter of fact. It's a fact whether or not it's a law.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
You can say that what the law means is a matter of opinion, and perhaps even expert opinion, but if there is no law, that's a fact issue.
Right. But they also get to rule, do they not, on whether the law is just. I mean, they can decide that the law is, in their view, quote-unquote, unconstitutional and render an acquittal on that basis, right?
That's right.
But the judges are quite effective, apparently, at dissuading them from exercising any such notion if they, in fact, even are aware that they have that power.
Yeah, well, the American people are not educated on how to be good jurors.
Right.
That's one of the main things we needed to fix.
Right.
Hopefully, there'll be some people listening to this program for whom that's a new idea, and they'll look into it and educate themselves.
Exactly.
We need more people like us to get on juries.
Absolutely. But do you think there's anything, do you think if you were part of a pool of prospective jurors, that the mere fact that you are knowledgeable and that you run this website, constitution.org, do you think that would cause you to be excluded from being on a jury?
Well, if they found out about it, but I was called for jury duty not too long ago, and it never came up. The only reason I wasn't called is because my number was too high. If I had had a lower number, I think I would have been called. Now, that was, of course, a more like an ordinary criminal trial,
right?
Which there might not have been any constitutional issues.
Right.
So, you know, most cases are ordinary cases.
Right.
You know, but there may still be an issue if the law is not properly argued in the presence of a jury. So even if it's only a statute.
Right. But, you know, John, even if I, even on a so-called ordinary case, if I were called as a juror, having been to three federal tax trials and knowing that the judge has almost unlimited latitude in what he or she will allow as evidence to be brought in on either side, I would, even in a you know, say a criminal trial, you know, burglary or robbery or murder or whatever, I would still be extremely suspicious that maybe there's evidence that one or both sides are not allowed to admit in court because of the judge's arbitrary ruling on that.
Yeah,
that would bother me a lot.
And that's an important thing to be suspicious about, which is why jurors need to be able to ask questions about things like that. In fact, jurors need to be able to call their own witnesses if necessary.
Wow. You're going to have, this occurs to me, we really need a whole course taught by somebody like you, John, if we can figure out how to do it over the web, where people could learn about this process.
Well, it's on my website. Just go to
constitution.org. The website's great, but I think people need the leadership of a teacher who will take them through this huge amount of material and point out, I mean, structure it in such a way that the novice can grasp it. Because the average person isn't going to read the wealth of information on your website, I'm afraid. They won't know where to go or what to look up.
Well, what I've been suggesting lately, there are two meetup groups already established, although, of course, not a lot of local ones, but a theme. There's the U.S. Constitution or United States Constitution, and there's also a constitutionalist meetup group. And if you will go to meetup.com and find those and join them, and if you can get enough people in a local area, maybe, say, eight people, then you can form a local group and start holding meetings and discuss these things among yourselves. And if you get enough people, maybe you can call in somebody like me to come in and conduct seminars.
Okay, that's what we need to do. Yeah, I think we need to take advantage of this, you know, relatively new technology called the internet now, and make expertise that you have and other various people have around the country, like Edwin Vieira and Larry Beecraft, more open. I'm just musing out loud, kind of. But I mean, there's got to be a way. Radio talk shows are fine, but only a limited number of people can call in. And
These conference call systems you can sign up for, where everybody can get on, you know, hundreds of people can get on the line at the same time.
That's
one method. People can hold a meeting and just have the lecturer appear, you know, via television, essentially.
Right.
Two-way television. So there are a lot, you know, conference video, that is.
Right.
So there are lots of technical solutions apart. Of course, there's always the old standby, just, you know, buy the guy's airfare in a hotel room and have him come out and lecture to you.
We may have to do that with you sometime here in Kansas City. So
I've done a fair amount of that.
Good. We do have another caller on the line. We have Carl from Kansas. So, Carl, are you there?
Yes, I'm stunned by your guest's statement that in an ordinary criminal case, there may not be any constitutional issues involved. It seems to me that in criminal cases, pound for pound, you have more constitutional rights and issues involved than in even the most complicated civil case. You have innocence until proven guilty. You have the right to a jury. You have the right to effective assistance of counsel. And it seems to me that if jurors were fully informed and were sitting in a jury trial on a criminal case, even a routine or so-called ordinary case, it's not routine or ordinary if it's going to jury trial. I can tell you that right now, because as I'm sure your guests would agree, statistics show that 95% to 98% of all cases are settled by plea bargain. So what we need is jurors to say, hey, this case, I'm going to be looking to see the law. I'm going to be looking to make sure this guy's constitutional right.
Okay, Carl, we're heading up to a break. Can you hold over the break for us?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. We'll be right back, folks, and we'll continue with Carl's comment, and question.
Hi, this is John Statler, and I want to tell you about a new shortwave receiver that we're really excited about. It's the Kato KA1103, and let me tell you, this radio has features and performance of receivers costing 2 to 3 times the price. Features include dual conversion phase lock loop tuner for continuous coverage of the entire shortwave band, AM, FM, and medium bands, 268 memory presets, single sideband reception with fine-tuning control, signal strength, meter, battery, power indicator, DX local select, tone select, auto backlight screen, extra-long telescopic antenna, line out and external line in jacks, and many other features too long to list. And when you purchase a Kato KA1103, you just don't get a radio, you get an entire radio package, including an external antenna, stereo earbuds, and an AC adapter, rechargeable batteries, and a nice carry pouch. So if you've been considering buying a shortwave receiver or would like to upgrade from your present radio, the KA1103 at just $110 plus $9 shipping is an outstanding value. Call us at 800-724-2719. 800-724-2719.
Have you heard of a privacy crisis? Odds are you're already immersed in one. The U.S. government is now legally tapping phones, monitoring emails, tracking purchases, and seizing property in record numbers. Banks are demanding invasive personal information for even the smallest transaction. Unfortunately, stalkers looking to harm you or your financial situation are using the same methods. So how can you protect yourself, your loved ones, and all that you own? Well, the first step is to purchase the most important how-to book you'll ever read. It's called Privacy Crisis by author Grant Hall. In minutes, you'll know the methods he himself has used and advised others about in order to bank anonymously, open a safety deposit box without a social security number. With Privacy Crisis, you'll discover how to avoid judgments, seal your credit files airtight, drop off the radar, and virtually disappear from those looking to cause you injury. The ebook and hardcover versions are available at www.privacycrisis.com. Grant Hall's Privacy Crisis contains information and legal methods the powers that be don't want you to know. Travel, bank, work, and live anonymously. Live free. You can also order Privacy Crisis by telephone. Call 702-433-6222.
Morning, neighbor.
Hey, shouldn't you be at work?
I am. As a matter of fact, I pulled another all-nighter.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Well, at least I'm making money 24/7, but I never have to go to work.
So what do you do?
Not very much at all now. About a month ago, I heard about this website. It's got a funny name. It's DidYouRobBillGates.com.
That is funny.
Yeah, you can earn $1,200 to $12,000 a week starting the very first week.
Oh, is that how you bought that new mower?
Yeah, and the motorcycle I've always wanted, too. You should log on. Find out how you can become financially free.
So what was that website?
It's www.DidYouRobBillGates.com.
Just wait, I'll go get a pen so I can write that down.
You don't need to write it down, it's easy to remember. DidYouRobBillGates.com.
Yeah, DidYouRobBillGates.com. That is easy.
It's easy, and the money is awesome.
Okay, welcome to the Peter Mac Show again, and my special guest is John Roland, founder and president of the Constitution Society, and we have Carl on the line making some points about the relevance of the Constitution in criminal or even so-called ordinary trials. So continue, if you would, Carl.
Well, yes, thank you, Peter. So I guess my question for your guest is if he could explain that statement or maybe expound on this. It just seems to me that a juror needs to be asking himself questions in any criminal case if it's being tried. What I was saying right before the break was most criminal cases, in fact, almost all criminal and civil cases are resolved through either plea bargaining or settlement. So if you have a criminal case that you're actually sitting on a jury, that tells you something's wrong, something's going on, something's out of the norm. And as a juror, it's not enough just to say, are they arguing the law? To me, they have to say, does this person have effective assistance of counsel? Is their right to confrontation being preserved? In other words, for example, are the witnesses being forced to take the stand and tell their story, or is hearsay coming in? Or do they have a screen? Is it a recording, a video hookup? I mean, there's all sorts of issues at play. And, of course, a juror can't ask those questions if they don't know the Constitution. So, anyway, I guess I just was enjoying your guest, but was stunned by that statement.
Yeah, well, it's a fair question, and my the statistics on cases that go before juries, it in state court, is that most of them are not involved in a really big way with constitutional issues. Things like murder cases, for example, where there really isn't a question whether there's a law against murder. There were the jury is mainly a value in assessing the credibility of witnesses. Is this witness really credible in that when he said that he saw so-and-so? But, of course, where you really get involved in the constitutional issues is in federal cases, because the overwhelming majority of federal cases are drug cases, and let's face it, the federal government has no authority to prosecute anyone for the possession or sale of drugs.
Right.
You know, so right off the bat, if you sit on a federal jury in a drug case, if you have studied my website and the Constitution, you should know, well, that there is no law. So,
yeah, I guess if I understand Carl's point, though, John, it's that if stuff going on behind the scenes, maybe, you know, are about the witnesses, there may be things going on behind the scenes be out of sight of the juror that are relevant to constitutional questions.
Yeah. Well, we have to realize there are limits to what jurors can expect to be able to do if they don't have any information at all about what is going on.
Well, Peter, if I might just restate my question, I guess my point is that it's the process itself that involves constitutional rights. For
yeah.
example, here in Kansas, where I live, on misdemeanors, a criminal defendant only gets a six-person jury. Now, that's not constitutional because the Sixth Amendment, when it was written to ensure and guarantee the right to a jury trial, the Founding Fathers meant 12 people, and they meant a unanimous verdict. But in Kansas, you're only required to get six. So to me, that's the first question the juror says is, where's the other half of the jury?
Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, I did a recent short article on that I'm planning to expand, in which I show that the importance of the 12-person jury, because as I argue in the article, the majority of people in the community have always been somewhat negligent as far as being good jurors is concerned. The proportion of the members of the community who are prepared to be good jurors has always been a minority. Of course, they're even more of a minority now than they used to be.
Well, most people I talk to, whether they're even aware or not, and it's sad to say, but even the ones who are aware, they dread getting called for jury duty and they don't want to serve. So I'm going to hang up and listen to the rest of the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your questions, Carl. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, let me finish that point.
Sure.
Anyway, what it shows mathematically, if you assume, let's say, some percentage of the population is prepared to be a good juror,
right,
then if the merits of the case are such that the defendant should be acquitted, is more likely to be acquitted if it's a jury of 12 than if a jury of 6, and the proportion of the population that needs to be good jurors in order to make that difference goes from 6% to 11%. So if we were to conduct our own program of public education to prepare the public to be better jurors, if for six-person jurors, we'd have to reach 11%, whereas for 12-person jurors, we'd only have to reach 6%.
6% of the population that is prepared to be, quote-unquote, a good juror, right?
Right.
Okay.
In other words, we'd have to. That's how many we'd have to prepare by education
right.
to be good jurors.
Okay, so, we'll have to take another break here. John, sorry to interrupt you. We're due for a break here at the bottom of the hour, so pick that up when we get back, folks. We'll stay with us.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
The ideology powering the Democrats and Republicans is not liberalism or conservatism, but globalism. Globalists are concerned with what's good for big business and the American empire instead of what's fair for the American people. The only antidote to the poison of globalism is nationalism. Start reading the Nationalist Times each month. The Nationalist Times promotes a common sense, intelligent, and passionate alternative to the reigning party line. Published monthly since 1985, the Nationalist Times is a 20-page newspaper featuring outstanding writers and columnists who don't believe in taboos or sacred cows. Be one of the many thousands of loyal readers of the Nationalist Times. Subscribe now to the Nationalist Times. Just $19 for 1 year. That's 50% off the regular price. Send your $19 subscription to the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. That's the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. Or subscribe online at our website, www.anu.org.
Hi, this is Brother Michael Diamond from Most Holy Family Monastery. We are now offering a critically important $10 package. The package contains three DVDs with 10 different programs, our new 658-page book called The Truth About What Really Happened to the Catholic Church After Vatican II, which is the most comprehensive book ever produced on what has happened to the Catholic Church in the last 50 years. You also get another 335-page book and other material. Order now at our website, mostholyfamilymonastery.com. The last word monastery is spelled M-O-N-A-S-T-E-R-Y. At the website, you can watch all of our videos for free, read sample chapters of the new book and other articles, or call us 24 hours a day at 1-800-275-1126. That's 1-800-275-1126. Or you can mail in your order to us at Most Holy Family Monastery, 4425 Schneider Road, Fillmore, New York, 14735. The price of the whole package is $10, which includes media mail shipping, $15 for UPS ground, or $30 outside the U.S. MostHolyFamilyMonastery.com.
Why continue suffering from pain, illness, and disease when natural health and wellness therapies are within your reach? Hundreds of people are reporting improved health and wellness using Rife frequency technology. In the 1920s, research scientist Royal Raymond Rife discovered that disease organisms can be destroyed using resonant frequencies. The BioSolution frequency instrument uses the same technology for relief or elimination of pain and disease conditions. There are no reported side effects. Join others in discovering a return to natural health and wellness. Just don't treat the symptoms, eliminate the cause. BioSolutions has over 550 pre-programmed auto sequences for various health conditions, and it's very easy to use. Customer satisfaction is guaranteed or your money back. For more information, call BioSolutions toll-free at 866-885-6625. That's 866-885-6625. Once again, that number, 866-885-6625.
Welcome back to the Peter Max Show. We have about just less than a half an hour left. And, John, I want to let you, of course, expound on your point that the commercial interrupted here. But let me just remind callers, if you want to call in, the lines are open. You can call us at toll-free at 800-313-9443. So continue, please, John.
Okay, well, just my point is that in order to turn the situation around, we have to be able to educate a lot of people.
Right.
We're basically changing the legal and political culture.
Right.
So even if we were to teach people in public school how to be good jurors, which that used to happen in public schools, if you go to my website, there's a book called The American Manual, which was a textbook of from 1854 that was used to teach upper level, what we today call high school students, and
right.
lower level college students.
Right.
And it's all basically all about how to be a good juror and how to be a good militiaman. I mean, it goes
wow.
through the Constitution, the entire Constitution, but the emphasis is on jury duty and militia duty.
Wow.
And so people, a person who took the course, who read the textbook, might be expected to be fairly well prepared to be a good juror.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that today we're having to catch people when we can. We can't make them sit down and study. So we're having to do the best we can to impart these ideas to them. and it would be an enormously expensive effort to even reach 6%. And
right.
It wouldn't just be twice as expensive and difficult to reach 11%. It would be like 100 times as difficult and expensive. So that's why something like the difference between six men juries and 12 is so important, and why it's so important to insist on juries of 12.
Right. But is this just another instance where the judges who are so deficient in their legal acumen, as you pointed out, would look at the amendment and say, well, it's not in there. The Sixth Amendment reads as follows. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have assistance of counsel for his defense. If Scalia can read the Ninth Amendment and say, well, I don't see any rights in there that a person has a right to have his petition for redress responded to by the government, couldn't a Scalia or lower level judge read the Sixth Amendment and come up with the same thing, saying, I don't see anything that says that jurors have to be 12?
Well, see, the thing is that the courts have held, I believe incorrectly, that amendment only applies to the federal government and federal courts and not to the state government courts, and
uh-huh.
that it's not been extended, or what they call incorporated, mm-hmm. by the 14th Amendment to apply to the states.
Uh-huh. Okay.
There was a Supreme Court decision that it was okay for states to have juries of less than 12. Now, the opinion was expressed that there has to be some lower limit, and they wound up accepting 6, but like a jury of 1 would clearly be, out of the question. So the problem is that they framed it in terms of the jury being a cross-section of the community, and nobody did the kind of analysis that I did, showing what it would take, why a jury has 12 people.
Mm-hmm.
There's a mathematical analysis that is behind all of that.
Right. I've seen your emails on that. I need to study that more myself. But it's a little bit difficult to discuss on the air because it's hard to talk about exponents on the air.
Yep. Well, if you go to my website, you can find all this, including the exponents.
Okay. Okay. You mentioned the 14th Amendment, and that's another question where there are a number of people out there that have very different views on what the 14th Amendment actually did. What is your view on that?
Well, first of all, arguendo, if it was ratified, because the existing evidence is that it was not ratified.
That the 14th Amendment was not ratified.
Yeah, but if it were, and I personally hope it had, wish it had been.
Okay.
Because we need one. It was not very well worded. The framers of the 14th were not of the same intellectual caliber as Madison when it came to framing constitutional language. But leaving that aside, one can figure out what they meant from their debates in Congress, and they did, in fact, say that they intended it to incorporate all of the Bill of Rights. So, including by implication, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments.
Right.
So, the fact that later courts would decline to do so is certainly a problem. They interpreted due process to mean uniformity. It's due if it's uniform, and ignoring the level of protection that it's supposed to represent. Just because the process may be uniformly applied doesn't mean that it provides a comparable level of protection. And that's what I showed in my mathematical analysis.
Okay. Well, what I was getting at with my question was, and I'm not fully conversant in this question even, perhaps, but some people contend that the 14th Amendment created two kinds of citizens, U.S. citizens, and then the rest of us are just, you know, already citizens of whatever state we're in, and therefore we're, you know, quote unquote American citizens, but it gave government power over this new kind of citizen that it didn't previously have power over.
No.
Is there any merit to that argument?
That's nonsense.
Okay.
United States citizens existed from the founding of the Constitution. There's nothing new about new United States citizens. What the problem the 14th was trying to correct was that the states were defining citizenship differently than they were defined at the federal level. To make it, essentially, they were defining blacks as non-citizens,
right,
and therefore not entitled to rights.
Right.
Now, of course, in the federal level, rights attach to personhood. And even the southern states admitted that blacks were persons. They just, in effect, they tried to treat them as though they were foreign nationals visiting the country who could be mistreated, you know, freely.
Right.
Because they were not, you know, real citizens.
Right. Even so after
the foreign national visiting this country have all the same rights that other persons do. They just don't have a right to stay here. But, you know, other than that, they have the same rights over their persons.
Right.
But by attaching rights to citizenship instead of personhood and building a lot of precedence on that, the 14th Amendment was intended to do away with that by saying, in effect, that all persons are citizens.
And that's, I take it, what you mean by the poor wording of the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, all persons born or naturalized and who reside in a state are citizens of that state.
Okay.
So it's so the state couldn't, let's say, well, to use another example, if it didn't like, if Democrats won control of a state legislature, they couldn't define Republicans as non-citizens and
right,
therefore not entitled to the right to vote.
Right.
That they're not free to define their own criteria for who a citizen is and is not, and therefore who has rights.
Right. Let me switch gears here just a little bit, too, in the remaining 17, 18 minutes we have here. The so-called Commerce Clause of the Constitution is what many people contend has allowed the federal government unconstitutionally, I think, and we'll hear in a minute, to expand their powers way beyond what they really are limited in having. In other words, Congress has interpreted the so-called Commerce Clause as saying anything that crosses state lines, even telecommunications, gives us jurisdiction over it. Right.
And there are actually two things going on there. It's not just that they've expanded the definition of commerce. Most of what they've been doing is using the Necessary and Proper Clause. They aren't necessarily always saying that, let's say, anything that crosses the state line is commerce,
mm-hmm,
but that it affects commerce.
Right.
And by the Necessary and Proper Clause, we can regulate everything that affects commerce, even though it may not be commerce itself. Now, that's bogus.
Otherwise, they have no limits on their power, really.
Exactly, because
right?
Everything affects commerce.
Right.
So the Necessary and Proper Clause ends in some very important words. It says, necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing power.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, John. Can you tell us exactly which article and section you're citing here?
Yeah, Article 1, Section 8.
Okay.
Clause 18.
Okay.
And what,
go ahead. I'm
what
sorry.
It's saying, by carrying into execution it and being necessary and proper, okay,
right,
if it's necessary to lease office space and hire employees and print forms and instruction booklets and maybe get a horse or a now, of course, a motor vehicle. If all these things are necessary to carrying out the power, carrying into execution the power, then those are okay. The power to do does include doing that.
Okay.
On the other hand, if the only way that you can accomplish a regulated outcome is to kill everybody engaged in the activity that you're trying to regulate, that would not be a proper power,
right?
Extension of the power.
Right.
Okay. So it's not about getting outcomes. It's about making an effort. When you authorize somebody to do something, it's not you're not giving him the authority to do absolutely anything that it might take to accomplish an outcome.
Right.
You're only giving him the authority to make a certain kind of effort. And his outcomes are very likely to be beyond his control or yours. You can make an effort. If it ever doesn't work, you're stuck. You may resort to something else, but you can't do it under the authority of that delegated power.
Right.
I mean, you can have you can delegate the authority to a building manager to rent an apartment, but you can't delegate the authority to him to kill tenants if they mess up the apartment.
Right. Well, isn't the important part also then, as it reads here, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers? So these other laws that are necessary and proper have to be tied to the previously enumerated powers there in Section 8, right?
Right. And there are powers in other parts of the Constitution which are not, therefore, covered by the necessary and proper clause.
Can you give me an
which
example?
Which only refers to the powers delegated in Section 8.
Right. Can you give me an example of another power that's in the Constitution but not in Article 1, Section 8?
Well, for example, there's a power, preemptive power of Congress to regulate congressional elections.
Okay.
Okay, that's not one of the enumerated powers in the Section 8. Okay?
Okay.
And that is a power which has been expanded, I believe incorrectly, to include regulation of campaign financing and presidential elections and fundraising and advertising and all kinds of other things, which it has no authority to do. All it has authority to do is to regulate the time, place, and manner of elections.
Right.
The actual balloting. Okay,
right.
But not the place for the choosing of senators.
Right.
Make an exception for that. So it would be constitutional to, for example, if a state tried to say that the place of holding an election was on the moon, the time of the time for holding election was within a 1 microsecond timing, timing
right.
window, and the manner of election was you could only vote for a pre-approved, to a list of approved candidates that was approved by the party in power.
Right.
Okay. And Congress could legitimately step in and say, no, you can't do that. We won't allow that. You got to be able to provide plenty of polling places and make sure the vote is counted accurately and that people can get to the polls and they have plenty of time and all that sort of thing.
Right.
Got to be fair.
Right.
Now, if Congress were to do the same thing as the state tried to do that I just described, that would be unconstitutional.
Right.
I mean, just because Congress has a power to do something doesn't mean it has a power to do anything.
Right.
It only has power in certain legitimate directions.
Right.
The subject often comes up, and I'll mention it here, that, the other is the power to regulate the militia, but only in a direction of making it more effective. You can't regulate the militia in the direction of making it less effective. That's unconstitutional.
Right.
In fact, the standard for how effective the militia was supposed to be is they're supposed to be able to defeat the army if it ever came to that. If a militia is not prepared to defeat the army, then they're not being maintained in an adequate state of preparation.
Right.
So
let's take another caller here, John, if we could, in these last few minutes. So we have Bill on the line from Idaho. Bill, go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. Great program. I hope you have this guest on often and recurrently. I was wondering if he had had a chance. And first, is he attorney or member of bar or just by virtue of reading experience involved?
No, I can assure you that if I ever tried to apply for a bar card, that I would be immediately surrounded by big guys carrying guns, and they would haul me off to jail or something.
Well, that's encouraging. Not that you would be hauled off, but
Bill, can you hold through the break here?
Sure,
we're
sir.
Due for our last break,
sure.
So just please hold, and then we'll have John respond. We'll be back in just a minute, folks.
Have you heard of a privacy crisis? Odds are you're already immersed in one. The U.S. government is now legally tapping phones, monitoring emails, tracking purchases, and seizing property in record numbers. Banks are demanding invasive personal information for even the smallest transaction. Unfortunately, stalkers looking to harm you or your financial situation are using the same methods. So how can you protect yourself, your loved ones, and all that you own? Well, the first step is to purchase the most important how-to book you'll ever read. It's called Privacy Crisis by author Grant Hall. In minutes, you'll know the methods he himself has used and advised others about in order to bank anonymously, open a safety deposit box without a social security number. With Privacy Crisis, you'll discover how to avoid judgments, seal your credit files airtight, drop off the radar, and virtually disappear from those looking to cause you injury. The ebook and hardcover versions are available at www.privacycrisis.com. Grant Hall's Privacy Crisis contains information and legal methods the powers that be don't want you to know. Travel, bank, work, and live anonymously, live free. You can also order Privacy Crisis by telephone. Call 702-433-6222.
In Matthew 24, the disciples asked Jesus, "What shall be the signs of thy coming and the end of the world?" Jesus answered them, "You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines, diseases, earthquakes in many places. Fellow Americans, we are living in this time of Earth's history. People everywhere are trying to understand these climatic world events in light of human wisdom, but without the wisdom of God, this is impossible. Our ministry would like to offer information on the Mark of the Beast and the Unholy Alliance. It includes four books and several DVDs for your information. It discusses America in prophecy, the Antichrist, tyrants and wars, secret societies, the New World Order, and much more. So to be prepared for what is coming on the world as an overwhelming surprise, call for your free materials, Packet F, 888-211-1715. Again, 888-211-1715.
Take the heat out of your sleep. The Bedfan Personal Cooling System will work for anyone that is a hot sleeper, regardless of the reason. It gives you a deep, restful sleep, the way nature intended. No more tossing and turning. Say goodbye to sleepless nights. So ask yourself, are you a hot sleeper and really want to sleep cooler? A woman who suffers from the effects of menopause, including night sweats derived from hot flashes, have a medical condition that causes your body to get hot at night, or just want to save money on your air conditioning bill? It works instantly. No tools or assembly required. Don't worry. The Bedfan fits short beds, tall beds, beds with footboards, sleigh beds, water beds, and many other types of beds. If you want great relief and total comfort, give us a call at 1-210-632-8280. That's 1-210-632-8280. Or visit our site at bedfan.com. Your provider for great sleep.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're back here for just the remaining 5 or 6 minutes of the show, and we have Bill on the line. So, Bill, go ahead with your question or comment.
Yes, I was wondering if you or your guest by chance had a chance to look at a plea to some attorney by Richard H. Strand, ED. It's on radioliberty.com/attorney.html1. And if you get a chance, I was hoping the community, especially the people that are involved in the law, and dealing with these criminals that have infested the law would make special effort to get this, hopefully, to the good attorney up in Sandpoint or whatever that seems to be righteous or rumored to be. It's a request for an attorney to address Oliver Ellsworth, Supreme Court Chief Justice of 1796's discussion speaking to Congress, providing a rule to regulate our proceedings, told the court we cannot depart from it. The present Congress can provide such a rule and enforce it by taking away court jurisdiction in every future case where it is broken. The action would be irrefutable. Article 3, Section 2, Paragraph 2 of the Constitution. I was wondering what your guest would think in regard to that and how possibly that might be implemented or help in this desperate time of the Republic.
Go ahead, John, if you're clear on the question.
Well, that's another big bucket of worms, which is judicial rules of procedure. Congress asserts the power to write, to enact rules of procedure, and the courts routinely assert the right to ignore Congress's enactments. And right now, the judicial rules of procedure represent a kind of compromise in which the courts have gone along with Congress when they agreed with them, but when they don't agree, they go off on their own in their own direction. But basically, the courts have been writing their own rules of procedure for a long time. Now, the question is, what do we do about that? It's not really quite true that Congress has the authority, in my view, to remove jurisdiction freely. There always has to be jurisdiction in some court somewhere that's not too inconveniently located to hear any case that can be framed as a judicial question. Now, that doesn't mean that they can't remove jurisdiction from a particular court, which really means a particular judge, but if they do, they have to give it to somebody else. Now, there are some jurisdictions that cannot be removed from the Supreme Court. It has original jurisdiction. On all other cases, it has appellate jurisdiction, and the Constitution allows a transfer of jurisdiction between original and appellate, but not the removal of jurisdiction from all courts completely.
But if they are not behaving and acting in the best interest of the people, nor the Constitution, which they took an oath to support, defend, and protect, then there would be action at a common law grand jury to find them in default?
Well, strictly speaking, there's no such thing as a common law grand jury, as that term is being used by a lot of people. The grand jury has to be appointed by a legitimate court, or convened by a legitimate court. Now, once it's convened, it can go off on its own and do anything it wants. But the mechanism for appointing it has to be official. And it also is supposed to be random, which it generally is not in most states today. So most grand juries are not really grand juries because they're not really...